it is identity politics, but that's because numerous amounts of identities that don't conform to the up until now majoritarian identities have been shut out of the political process in the United States. And it's obvious to a lot of people who don't necessarily have like a big political skin in the game. But the question is, you know, to ask people to wait for justice with the tools at their disposal now, social media is just, you know, you can't, it's impractical.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to another edition of Liberal Half Hour, Liberal Halvtime in Norwegian. My name is Erik Løkke, and today I am joined by Jonathan Roth, political analyst and former chair, Democrats Abroad, Norway. We discuss the modern-day progressive movement, its roots, and contemporary ideology. Is the Democratic Party moving to the left? And will Joe Biden be a transformative president? Meaning, will he be a president that fundamentally changes America? Also, I would assume, even expect, regular listeners of Liberal Halvtime to know that I am and have been highly critical of Trump and the Republican Party, as I believe we can no longer trust the party's democratic sentiments. However, I have also been critical of the development in the Democratic Party by its focus on identity politics and the rise of so-called wokeness. John does not share my beliefs and explains why during our conversation. We have a lot to cover, and we spend an extended half hour today, so let's get started. Here I give you my conversation with Jonathan Roth. Jonathan Roth, thank you so much for joining Liberal Halvtime, Liberal Half Hour.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always nice to be with you, and in this day and age when I'm usually asked to come on to comment about one fire or another, it's nice to take a more of a deep dive into the ethos of the party structure and the government and talk about things that I have interest in and that and enlighten your listeners on.
Well, I look so much forward to having this discussion, which is about the Democratic Party. You're a former chair of the Democrats Abroad in Norway. And just let me ask you, why did you become a Democrat, not a Republican or an independent?
Well, it's actually quite an interesting question. I'm originally from New York, and a lot of people think nowadays that New York is this liberal bastion, this kind of fortress of democratic politics. But it wasn't always like that. Even up until about 7 or 8 years ago, we had a solid 20 years of Republican dominated city politics. From Mike Bloomberg was a Republican, and of course Rudy Giuliani was the mayor when I was growing up. But there was a very, very long tradition of Northeastern Republican politics, so much so that when I was growing up in the 90s, we had a Republican governor. We also had a longtime Republican senator named Alphonse D'Amato, and he was pretty much the quintessential New York Republican, in which the party at that point was very much interested in policy related to mostly spending and did not have very, very many qualms about social issues at the time. They were more about the price and size of government and services rendered. And this Senator D'Amato was known as Senator Pothole, you know, the holes that happen in the streets, because he was so interested in servicing the community that he represented that he would make sure that at any time his office got called, they would fill a pothole, they would fix a street, they would fix a railroad crossing, etc. That was what was important. And so after a generation of what you might call mismanagement by the Democrats in New York City and beyond in the generation preceding me, as much as I didn't really necessarily have a political identity of which to speak growing up, I would have identified myself necessarily as kind of like a New York Giuliani, bringing order to kind of what became New York chaos in New York up until.
And this was a very different Giuliani from what we see today.
Oh yes, he was a very legitimate figure up until he went to run for the Senate right around the year 2000, and honestly against Hillary Clinton that year that she was running to become the senator of New York. But this is the second part of the answer, is that right around the time of everything kind of changed around the election of 2000 and the troubles we had afterwards. And the Republican Party really took a hard rightward turn, in which the issues that used to be more regional and religious based became national, and then things started becoming nationalized on a local level. And it really pulled the party away from the old school kind of more moderate Republicans that existed up in the Northeast. Now it's really accelerated over the last 15 or 20 years, but there are none of which to speak anymore, literally on the national level. But you know, I'm more of what you would consider a moderate Democrat now. I mean, I worked in investment banking in New York, and there are a lot of people in the Democratic base in New York who are more moderate, mostly because when the business environment does very well in New York, the tax revenue that comes in from trading and good business helps the rest of the state. It's actually like, if I'm going to speak honestly about it, it is the kind of place where the trickle down effect actually works in a certain extent. But you have to have a real successful business base in order to work it that way. Now,
would you be comfortable with the Wall Street Democrat, like Larry Summers or ones like that?
I mean, listen, I had no qualms with the Clinton administration, and I guess you'd say my political metamorphosis really grew out of what I hold dear personally on a cultural wavelength, right? I mean, whatever I may have felt, I was never strong enough of a partisan in my local politics that I would let the things that I think about more moralistically, the safety net, et cetera, I could not shut my eyes to that, just to get a tax cut or whatever. You see that a lot in amongst the very, very wealthy. On a personal note, my mother passed away when I was 6 years old, and my father availed himself of the limited safety net upon which it exists, the Social Security safety net for those who lose parents as young children. There is a limited safety net there, and we wouldn't have survived without that. You know, a lot of what politics is the experience of experiencing the programs where they hit you. A lot of the reason why a lot of rural America doesn't like paying high taxes is because the redistribution of money that comes in and goes out, a lot of the services go to the cities and people with high density. So you are, you know, living out in a farm in South Carolina in the middle of nowhere, and you're paying for road work done in like the capital, and you feel like it's not hitting you. But up until it doesn't hit you until you actually need it. And then you realize that you need these kind of things. So it's, I can talk about the shifting personal politics, but also shifting national politics and how they intersect for a long time. But the bottom line is that I believe there's a role of government in the lives of the people that they serve. You know, the government is us. But I also came up in a generation at the height of the, I guess you would call it, like the austerity state in the United States. You know, we've gone, and I can talk about this a little bit later, but we've gone on these kind of 30, 35 year parabolas of austerity and spending, and how, you know, we have these ideas politically and like the grand scheme of things that things get out of control one way or the other, and they reorient themselves when generations kind of come through and leave and new ones come up. And in the 90s, it was very much a time of reorienting our spending politics for a variety of reasons. But when the rubber hit the road and I became an adult, I guess in the real world, I became a Democrat, and the party has only gone in a further rightward direction, which I couldn't see myself a member of that party in a million years now.
Right. And you already touched upon it in terms of the development in the Democratic Party. Obviously, I'm most concerned about the Democratic Party today, but there's always a story to that, and we could argue where to begin. But if you would try to have a very brief explanation about the Democratic Party since the Second World War, the 90s, and up to today, just the main things, how would you explain it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the modern Democratic Party, you wouldn't go as far back as Wilson, potentially, though you see some parts of foreign policy in the Wilson era, moves to have the League of Nations, et cetera, after World War One. But I mean, mostly we trace the modern Democratic Party back to FDR. I mean, he was around for three terms, and his programs that that were the foundation of the New Deal. Many of them have become the foundation of what we know to be as benevolent government in the life of the United States. Now, over the course of long periods of time, with the benefit of time passing, we get to see clearly how things have changed and why they've changed. Now, for the most part, after World War II, the Democrats held the House. They held the House up into the 90s as an aside for almost 50 years, with only a break of about 2 years. Now, the old base of the Democratic Party, and this is before and after the Civil Rights Bill has changed everything, was very much the Workers' Party. We were never known as the Labor Party, but we were always like a Workers' Party, because the unions were never like really aligned with the government one way or the other. So it was always the workers versus the means of production, et cetera, the way it is anywhere else. But we have our own subtle nuances to our politics. Now, during that time, we had the Cold War, and we had the space race and things of that nature, and the Democrats were running the House. And so, fair or not, over time, they were tagged as like the tax and spend liberals. They wanted to take your money, they wanted to put the money in all these programs. Now, you could say that they wanted to keep equilibrium in the world, and took a lot of money. We were caught flat-footed when Sputnik happened in 57, and we had to pump billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars into the space program. And then we had the Great Society program under LBJ. So we were expanding government and keeping taxes at like a legitimate rate, and this fueled all this growth after the war. Then you got to the 60s, in which the politics changed because Kennedy and Johnson put in the civil rights laws. Now, that is when all the Southerners began to culturally shift to the Republican Party and change what the Republican Party was. And that was supercharged by the Nixon campaign in 68 and in 72, the Silent Majority and Southern Strategy campaigns, which really put in, we are going to focus only on getting 50% plus one vote in these regional places and really start to cleave the country. A lot of people say that it was in 1968, Bobby Kennedy was basically the apotheosis of what democratic politics was going to be, which was to unite the minority workers and the poor whites into this synthesis of everyone raising up together. And he was doing a good job. And then he was assassinated, unfortunately. And so no one's ever been able to really recreate that, because right after that is when the Republican Party decided to have their first incarnation of a kind of diabolical politics. And that in that respect, if we're going to be totally honest, and we've never really recovered. I mean, if you take that generation, I have two generations from the 30s and 40s with FDR, we came to, even right after Watergate, there was just a tiring of the status quo, of the spending, a lot of spending on the Cold War. We weren't really doing a lot. We were making any kind of notable progress, even though in retrospect, you think about this kind of big game in the world, the Soviets versus the US, the progress wasn't actually to render a defeat. It was to keep equilibrium and keep safety. But we at the time didn't know it. And we had Carter after Nixon. There wasn't a lot of, there was a malaise. And then ever since then, even though the Republicans didn't take the House until the 90s, when Reagan came in, he ushered in this new age of austerity thinking, which was the government is bad. You know, the word that he famously said, the scariest things the person can hear is, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And you have all the, you have all these,
the nine most terrifying words in the English language.
Exactly. And then you have, everything is kind of reflexively going back towards taxing and spending. And then for the last 40 years, regardless of the reasons why all the spending and taxing was taking place, Democrats got tagged as these spending crazy liberals. Now, it may be true, as I said, on the local level, you know, New York City went broke in the 70s. You had a lot of problems in the 70s with crime. You had a lot of, and on a local level, and fair enough, you know, there was a different type of politics back then. It was a lot of, not the cleanest type of politics on the city level. It wasn't as accountable. You know, there's a lot of what you call ward bosses and, you know, different types of schemes in which to secure votes and whatnot and patronage. And it was dirty on the local level. On the national level, a lot of the spending that needed to be done was done for generally good reasons. And a lot of the policies were put in by both Republican and Democrat presidents. Yet it was the birth in the 80s of kind of like big messaging. And the Reagan mantra really was, the government's bad. We got to shrink the government, you know, shrink taxes, support trickle-down economics, et cetera, et cetera. So that it became almost a article of faith, not only in Republican circles, but really in everyone but like the most progressive circles, that, you know what, yeah, government is too big. We've been living under this regime for like 40 years since the New Deal. No one ever really checked it.
So that just to push back on one thing here, John, and it's, I would say it's true that the Reagan messages and the rhetorics were very much about small government. But if you look at the big numbers, government percentage of GDP, of course, military spending here plays a role. But I mean, Reagan had a very good relationship with Tip O'Neill, the giant Democrat in the House. So he really never got to attack the New Deal like the most right-wing supporters did. I mean, the programs, there were some cuts, but like the big picture is that they didn't do too much. And it also comes back to the fact that many Republicans support smaller government as an abstract. But if you really try to attack the rights in pension, social security, or whatnot, I mean, Reagan secured together with Tip O'Neill social security until 2037 or whatever, if you know what I'm saying here.
You and I actually are in 100% agreement, because the next thing that I was going to say was that it was really the messaging. This is, I mean, as an aside, this is why when Obama was asked, he referred to Reagan as a transformational president, but not Bill Clinton in a certain way. But that's because Reagan was able to kind of paint the country anew rhetorically and through his like posture and through his kind of cheerleading of the country, but and moving it psychologically in a different direction. And what it did was it created the environment for then Bill Clinton to come in, and he was the one who deep sixed the welfare state. The Democrat did it. Mm. And so we are now, I mean, a good way of understanding politics now and kind of like the new agenda is to understand that at that time we were at the end of like a 35-year parabola of spending and kind of like the administrative state playing a role in growth and things of that nature. And there was just kind of like a fatigue for that. The old generation, the silent generation, and the greatest generation were kind of coming through, the boomers. And then now they're kind of on the wane, and we have these new generation, the Gen Xers are becoming the older ones, and you have the Gen Z and the millennials. And they have kind of this this generational amnesia about a lot of these things that we, you know, people like me and you who are, you know, gracefully going into our 40s now, we have kind of these flashbacks from when we were young bucks in the 90s, when things were a different way. It was the end of history. There was no more, you know,
much more optimistic era.
But you know, the kids that are now, you know, running tech and have jobs, they weren't even born then. And it's, I guess everyone kind of goes through this time. I mean, just on a personal level, but politically it's ripe for change. And so while people who are, you know, political analysts as a profession, they are kind of like shaken by the change and wow, a $6 trillion agenda, et cetera, et cetera. But the people below are like, well, you know, it hasn't worked for us. So this is where we're going because we don't know anything else. And let's try something else. So
a huge shift, as I see it, and I suspect you agree, is the level of polarization, the level of bad faith discussion and politics in the US. I mean, you probably felt it obviously much more closer. And when you assess the Obama years, there is an ongoing discussion how much for the lack of cooperation across the aisle is because Obama didn't reach out enough. I mean, did Mitch McConnell and John Boehner only want to obstruct? I mean, the way you see it kind of depends on where you stand, doesn't it? But from your point of view as a Democrat, I mean, you can give your own comments and thoughts on the issue, but also did the Obama years, were there a disappointment for many Democrats?
A lot of people think that they were a disappointment mostly because, I mean, as we're seeing right now, we're in negotiations in the Congress for very large bills. We're negotiating with, I say we, the royal we as Democrats, but the Democrats are negotiating with the Republicans. And back in the early part, when we were trying to get out of the epic economic distortions of the Great Recession, the Democrats and Obama were caught negotiating essentially against themselves, and they wound up taking deals. A lot of Democrats feel like when the Republicans didn't want to play ball, they should have gone with their own original deals and try to muscle them through. It's kind of short-sighted. I try to be charitable to a lot of people who aren't necessarily professional politickers, if you will, but they have kind of feelings on a lot of things, and they realize that they don't realize necessarily that politics is the art of the possible, you know. And I remember during the health for Obamacare, the healthcare debate, they really had to change things substantially and get it, and they were still twisting arms in the end, and they had to do what they call making people walk the plank, knowing that in order to get this big thing in, you're not going to get reelected. You're going to lose your job. But the real thing that changed everything was from like 08 to 2010 was the real beginning of social media and disinformation. And I don't know if it caught on here in Norway, but the big thing in Obamacare was death panels. And they said that Obamacare is going to be, the government's going to take over. And all of a sudden there's going to be a panel that the government sets up to decide who lives and who dies.
It was kind of popularized by Sarah Palin, wasn't it?
Exactly. And once that kind of thing hits, it takes on a mind of its own. And then the people who want to believe it, believe it. We're seeing a lot of this stuff now. I mean, that was the burgeoning of now, like the big, that was like this, one of the small lies, you know, because that kind of thing doesn't affect like the bedrocks of democracy necessarily. It just is like taking advantage of people who aren't very well informed. But that was the beginning of realizing if you could take an inch, you could take a mile if you could start manipulating people's like reality without enough kind of pushback. And it was the disintegration of the old media. And I mean, I think we can actually trace a lot of the troubles that we have now back to the beginning. People kind of poking around on messaging and seeing how you can kind of like micro target people and get people on your side, because it resulted in, you know, like the loss of 60 some odd seats in the congressional election in 2010, like less than 2 years later. Ironically, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is like the most popular thing now that it's, you know, steeped in the tea for quite a long time now, but the disinformation swirling around made it so that they had to take what they could get in the end and get the ball rolling. But that's the art of politics, is that you can't get everything in the first time. You have to kind of put your mark down, put your flag down, and then build upon it. But unfortunately, we live in like 5 minute long cycles where people are get aggrieved about something, and these things take many, many years to catch on.
So the interesting part is that people seem to tend to move towards status quo. So once you have something, it's difficult to take it away.
Oh yes.
And obviously that was also the thing with Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, that people knew what they had. Mm-hmm. I mean, I also talked to what I would say very smart American friends. We're really scared about the system in Norway, about socialized medicine and so on. And obviously the healthcare system is 2-3 podcasts alone, but yeah. Still you have this mechanism that once you have something, it's difficult to take away. And that's what we saw when you had the Republicans had the majority in Congress. They couldn't repeat it.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I don't put anything past the Republicans. I think that if Trump was a more tactile politician, he could have brought it past. But he decided to make enemies of the people whose votes that he wanted, like John McCain, et cetera. Like if he knew how to operate like a carrot and stick politician, that they could have gotten that one done. But he only has one tool, and it's a hammer. So right now, for example, somewhat controversially yesterday, the Biden administration declined to file an appeal to stop a gas exploration project that's going to happen up in Alaska. And everyone's hemming and hawing about why this is, because they're trying to pursue this electric based renewable economy. But to me, it's obvious that he's trying to get something from Lisa Murkowski, the moderate senator, and saying, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to help you, and you got to help me down the road. That's how politics works, right? Mm. People who wanted Trump wanted him to blow up a system, but the people who know how to work the system are the people who get things done. And that's the bottom line.
Right, right. And on that notion about Biden's kind of real politics or understanding the political game, he's been there for like 50 years in the Congress. Yeah. And the question I want to ask is about the direction of the modern Democratic Party. I briefly mentioned Obama. You could also mention Biden. Mm-hmm. Obama, as I saw him in 2008, he was kind of the center of the Democratic Party. Today, he would be clearly on the right. Biden has always been, yeah, kind of similar in the center. But how do you see it? The Biden, Hillary Clinton, Obama, the establishment?
Listen, I think that a lot of people get caught up. I'm not blaming you. A lot of people get caught up in what they refer to as the blue check marks, the people with like the loudest voices, the I guess you would call it like the agitating left. They are, without question, they're an important and rising bloc. I mean, a lot of the people who are getting elected in have replaced a lot of moderates, people who there's a lot of functioning reasons in the Congress why this has happened. I mean, I can just say specifically that the Democrats have no rules in the Congress for term limits on panels. And so people, right, they spend a long time trying to become the chair of something, and then they are there forever. So you have people like AOC and this Jamal Bowman up in New York. These are people that I know very well because I used to work with the Democrats in the New York delegation there. They replaced people who were there for years and years and years and years and years. And the organizational tools just didn't exist beforehand to organize against these people. They were machine politicians. So they're in there, yeah. But you need in the primary situation voting. It's not just as on the Republican side. It's not always representative of the country at large. But I wouldn't say that Obama would be on the right I think that the loudest voices are certainly on the left, but for the most part, we're still center left as far as the policies. We just have to see the kind of country and the world that we're becoming and not like look backwards, but look forwards. But
when you see center left, that's the whole American country as well.
No, the Democratic Party, right?
Is center left.
Yeah, because if we were, the Democrats are able to win elections in the middle of the country. We're able to pick off the odd governorship and still win enough Senate races out there. It's because, our party, unlike the other party currently, allows people to have an identity and have their own political identity with regards to pretty much everything except for the abortion issue at this. That's a whole other thing. Like the Democrats don't go trying to pick each other off because they don't have purity, except if they become pro-life. That's a whole other conversation. But luckily, that party, the politics of that has moved such that we've only had like one or two of those in like the last 10, 15 years anyway. Mm. So Otherwise, you're kind of, if you have a race that you need to win, you can be you, right? You don't have to have to pray to any sacred cows or anything. And so we maintain our foothold in the majority because of the diversity of our caucus. It goes everywhere from, Bernie Sanders, right? People just know, and they assume that just because he's a socialist, that he's kind of like at the far end, but he's pretty quite the conventional politician. You just have like a lot more young people out there who, if you really wanted to go into it, they would, think more, I guess you'd say, unconventionally politically to the progressive end. But I would say that's more because of the last 20 years of where we've gone through. A lot of the prescriptions for policy don't seem so outlandish to someone like that than someone who actually lived through communism and the Soviet Union, et cetera. These people the new generations don't know from that at all.
Right. Anyway. But if you see the Democratic coalition as such, and you would grade like AOC and Sanders more to the left, I would say Obama's more to the right. I mean, probably Joe Manchin is like the most right in the Democratic Party. But still, if you have Biden, Hillary Clinton, Obama.
Obama was constrained. I mean, I'll just say that Obama, I think that policy-wise, if he could do what he wanted, he would have been more to the left. But he didn't have the majorities that he needed after the first 2 years. So he was forced to have to deal with the realities of his situation. Now, after 2010, and in John Boehner's recent book, and I worked in the Congress at the time, he was extremely disempowered. The tail was wagging the dog pretty much 100% of the time. The Democrats.
You think he would do much the same thing that Biden's trying to do now?
Oh, Obama?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at the time, listen, we were coming out by the time he lost his majorities, we had already put the stimuluses in. So you have to think to yourself now, at this point in the Obama presidency, we had put in the stimulus, we had put in the bank and the auto bailout. And we were in a totally different sort of fiasco, right? So like We had come through the 90s when things were very good and things were still going fine. There was a lot of speculation on Wall Street, et cetera. I don't want to get too deep into like the reasons behind the economic collapse in 2008. But the people that caused that were mostly white collar people, and it affected mostly blue collar people and the working class. The economic situation that we're in now is one that affects everyone. One that pins that you can't really, it's not pinned on anyone, but the economic realities are on a kind of like flashing a neon that somehow, some way we have this K-shaped recovery in which the people on the top have still managed to make billions of dollars through this. And then the people below are struggling. And so, I mean, only the most strident partisan would not would disagree that the time is ripe for like a real big rethink on how we're going to go forward as a country. Now, there's a lot of other stuff going on, and I'm speaking specifically about like the top line numbers of the spending, right? $6 trillion seems like a crazy number, but you know, I don't know if you've been, if you or your listeners have been to America recently, the infrastructure is an absolute joke. You know, the way that we finance our highways is basically through a trust fund that's financed through the gas tax. But because the oil industry has had so much of a capture on the Republicans over many years, they don't want to put a damper on anyone driving. So they've like put all their weight on trying to make sure that the gas tax never gets even raised by one penny. And so it's chronically underfunded. And so we don't build anything. We don't maintain anything. And meanwhile, you have our competitors internationally building high-speed rail, building roads all over the place into the hinterlands and putting up infrastructure for electric. And so the Republican Party in America, they want to advertise and market on like, oh my God, this number, it's such waste to call it tax and spend. Liberal is just like the old days, but they're looking kind of at like a, I would say like a pre, not even just a pre-2020, but with all the inequality, it's more of like a pre-2000, 2008 old economy. This is the new economy. This money isn't just kind of like we're not having what you would call a Christmas tree in Washington. It's not just gifts for everyone like they want. This is necessary spending. They need to spend to remain competitive on the global scale here. Now, part of our problems politically, I know that you want to talk about polarization, et cetera. You know, we have a major education gap and misinformation problem and different things. But that's part of, I think, why the Republican Party they want to quibble over what infrastructure means. I mean, most countries believe that human infrastructure is part of like what modern infrastructure is, you know, and we want to add a couple of more years of schooling to give people a better education. And I think that they're afraid of educating the people better, to be quite honest with you. Just look at the numbers. But I can go on about that for a long time. I know you want to talk about more substantive things, but these are...
I think this is very substantive. I think it's very substantive things, and also the economic part of the discussion. But the last 10 minutes, I just want to take a brief look at the culture war and the term woke identity politics and how this is... your thoughts on how this affects the modern Democratic Party. From my point of view, this is one of the things that I'm most worried about, is the woke turn, in lack of a better expression, for many of the Democrats. Not so much their intentions in terms of fighting racism, fighting discrimination and all these things, but the modus operandi, I mean, which also Barack Obama, to mention him, has very much warned against this closing. You won't hear conservative thoughts on some campuses, the so-called activism, online harassment and whatnot. First of all, John, how do you see the term woke, which could mean pretty much not anything, but many things, and how this relates to the modern Democratic Party?
Well, first of all, I have to agree with President Obama. I think the extent to which the canceling has taken hold is a little too far as the targeting and trying to cancel and kind of, you know, remove people from the discourse. I think it's 100% legitimate to try to organize boycotts and stuff for advertising where people say inflammatory things, because I think that especially in this day and age with the reach of media and the kind of exponential propagation of ideas, videos and things like that, you can say something and if you have a backing, it just becomes a meme, right? And there's danger in that happening too much. And so you kind of, the one place where you can kind of try to influence people from going off the reservation too much is by influencing their financing. I mean, that's just the way it is. It's the society we live in. Now, when it comes to wokeness, right? You know, I'm going to take kind of like a philosophical shot at this one. You kind of have to put yourself, you have to put yourself first, and for the benefit of your listeners, you have to put yourself in like a huge, like diverse, multi-ethnic society, right? That has in theory guaranteed certain rights to people on paper. Now, there's no right or justice without enforcement. That's just number one. So we're talking about a country that has, since the beginning, since the Constitution, you know, we've had voting, but at first it was voting only for land holders, and then you had only a black person counted as 3/5 of a person. Native Americans were referred to as savages. Women didn't get the right to vote until 1921. That had to be a constitutional amendment. Fighting. These are long, long, long fights, right? Back after the Northern Army left the South after the Civil War in Reconstruction, we had this 60, I think, year period of Jim Crow, which was basically no one was there to enforce the laws. And so the descendants of the Confederates terrorized the black population down there, even though they theoretically had rights to vote. No one did. You wound up having in the North, you know, congressional seats being won on the count of 80,000 votes. And then down in like Alabama and Mississippi, they would have a grand total of like 5,000 votes for the same seats and the same voting, right? So then incrementally, you had, you know, the civil rights laws and different laws that guaranteed the right to vote and guaranteed the right to housing and all this kind of stuff. And America's been on this journey. But up until, I guess, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, everyone has kind of been on their own journey, disaggregated. You had to really join something. You had to become like a part of like the nonviolent student committees of Martin Luther King. You had to go out in the streets and march. You had to do all this kind of stuff. And the civil rights bills in the 60s literally only gave the black people the right to not get killed, theoretically, to vote. And that was like a really, really big deal. And then they had to have Martin Luther King. So the bottom line I'm saying is that the incrementalism is the killer here, where people are promised everything. And then there's always pushback. They get an inch. People do what's called either legal or non-legal nullification. They just ignore it if no one's willing to come in and enforce it. And, you know, you're a minority. This is real to you. Transgender people nowadays, they are real people. The gay people weren't allowed to marry up until less than a decade ago in America. In a lot of places, they don't have equal rights. They right now don't have the right to keep their job if they get fired, if their boss finds out that they're gay. And so really what has changed is social media and the ability to organize has now made people say, you know what? Enough with this incrementalism. We have rights. We are going to take our rights. We're going to self-police this because no one else is going to police it. No one polices it for us. So we have to be the police here of our own society, because the other component of this is demographically, we're only going in one direction. So the people that are really not only pushing back against it, but with glee, the real...
Speaking of pushing back, let me push back on some of that. I don't disagree with the challenges, although I would argue that things have improved, becoming better, not at the pace you would like to see, and especially if you're a minority. But I mean, this incrementalism or reform, as I would like to say it, is the kind of way, the liberal way. You don't ask for revolutions. You don't like destroy the order without having some serious unintended consequences. So my point is, again, not the problem with wokeness intentions and what they're trying to do. It's the way they are doing it. You briefly mentioned Obama, which I agree, the level of cancel culture, the level or the mechanism when used in self-policing, the way that that this tribalism works. If we are to follow one of the leading figures within the anti-racist movement, the wokeness, I would say that I have seriously problems with what they're arguing for in terms of the way they want to fight it, instead of going step by step forward to making sure that you improve things. Not to mention one unintended consequences in this defunding the police or attacking the police. Police reform in the US is totally necessary. They should learn a lot from Norway. Not everything from Norway, but a lot in terms of training and so on. No doubt about it. But who is going to suffer if nobody wants to become a police, or if the police withdraws from the areas where the crime? We're already seeing it. And you can have a lot of these unintended consequences if the woke people have their way.
You raise legitimate points. I'll give you the fact that they're legitimate. You and I are not going to agree. I mean, I happen to take the experience of the minority into consideration. I mean, it's easy to say things are going to get okay when you're not the one waiting for the justice. I think that
people within the minority communities also disagree about this. So, I mean, that's one of the problems I have with identity politics, not to say that minorities have bigger authority on the argues here than I do, but that's not the only thing. Arguments still matter, if you know what I'm saying.
No, they do. But how long is too long? How long do you wait for tokenism to run its course, for people to pat you on the back just because you're like a Hispanic male or a Black male who's made it to like a corporate boardroom, and all of a sudden you get, I mean, it shouldn't have to be that way in the year 2021. You've had programs of affirmative action in the United States throughout the years that have kind of tried to rectify these issues. And they've been taken and struck down in courts as unconstitutional because conservatives just don't want to give up, especially politically. I'm saying political conservatives in America don't want to give up under the guise of equal protections to allow minorities to get even a leg up, to try to kind of get the ball rolling, to give themselves a real semblance of true equality in the country. So you and I can respectfully disagree about it. I mean, it is identity politics, but that's because numerous amounts of identities that don't conform to the up until now majoritarian identities have been shut out of the political process in the United States. And it's obvious to a lot of people. They don't necessarily have like a big political skin in the game. But the question is, you know, to ask people to wait for justice with the tools at their disposal now, social media, is just, you know, you can't, it's impractical. So you have to try to kind of work with them. I think that the defund the police to a certain extent has been a very useful political marketing tool for the right. I think that, you know, so a couple of people said it. I think that what it really means, just for the benefit of your listeners, is that they want to redirect resources that go to just kind of outright policing to different aspects of social welfare and health and the police system, the way that sort of like the way that the politi works in Norway, in which it's kind of all things to all people. In America, police departments are basically people with guns and sticks to make sure that they keep the order. But when you have someone who's going through a mental health crisis, you don't necessarily need someone with a gun and a stick. You need someone to be able to talk you out of your mental health crisis. And that's kind of like what they meant by defund the police. But it's hard to speak in a bumper sticker for the purposes of that. And it was successfully used in the election against Democrats. You know, I think that we both want to get to the same end place where there's some sort of like justice, but that the people should not, there shouldn't have to be a loser. But when there's justice and there's a true meritocracy and people are able to kind of like spread their wings and do their best, I mean, that's a very conservative tenet.
But John, I think we should get back to an own program about wokeness. I have so much I want to push back and say and discuss, but being mindful of time here, I just want to have a final question here. And this is your expectations, your hopes for the Biden administration, if you can give your final comments on that.
Well, I'm very, you know, when he was running, one of his seldom said but very well noticed things was, when I'm president, sometimes you won't have to hear from me for like a couple of weeks at a time sometimes. And he's letting the fact that he is trying to do the right thing for the people win the day rather than any type of rhetoric or something that he's that he's trying to say or do publicly. I think that Americans get the picture. I think that we've all been on a harrowing ride over the last few years. The new way that I think I've spoken to you about this before, but since the beginning of the Trump era, they've been purging anti-Trump Republicans from the local parties, and a lot more of them have been elected to the legislatures. And the new trend is that we're seeing them try to take over not just the laws of the elections, but they're trying this next cycle. They're going to try to run to be the people who are running the elections, actually. Like, and we're in a precarious place as far as our future is concerned with regard to elections. Now, we have a new Justice Department. I foresee that they're sitting back and waiting and seeing all this. And they're going to, because we have the supremacy clause in our Constitution, the federal government rules the day one way or the other. You're going to see, I guarantee you, in some Republican held states, you're going to see these ends justify the means candidates get elected to run elections. It's very dangerous for our democracy. But hopefully the luckily Democrat administered Justice Department will be prepared to go in and adjudicate things properly and make sure that, you know, things aren't reverse stolen, if you will, from the big lie. You know, they're trying to institutionalize these doubts on our elections. So the answer to your question about Biden is that, you know, he's spending because the country needs this spending. We've gone through 35 years of austerity and we're in a new time. We're in a new time. And if you want to get deep into the politics, they're putting thousands of dollars into the pockets of parents in the country, and that's expiring a month before the next election. So they put that in as a poison pill to dare the Republicans to vote against its reauthorization. I encourage your listeners to kind of pay attention to the minutia, because there's a lot of this going on, and it's going to be very important to how we go forward in the midterm elections. But it's also a really good window into how politics works in normal times. Because we're essentially, you know, take away the specter of Trump and the craziness that goes on with the fringe of their party. We're back in the normal political times. And for that, I'm thankful.
Mm. I definitely want to go deep into the politics, but we should do that another time. I would very much like to have you back, John. So thank you for sharing your thoughts on this episode.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
Before we end, if you support our work, and I hope you do, please rate our show on iTunes and feel free to leave a review. This will increase our audience outreach. If you have comments or questions or critique, please feel free to send me an email. My email is, as always, eric@civita.no. Thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of the summer.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Moderne medier.